This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson. COVID hospitalisations are climbing across most states, but there's debate about how many of them should be officially counted. We'll have some vital information about how to manage COVID at home if you think you're positive but can't get it confirmed. Also, Australian and Chinese officials make an unusual show of unity ahead of the Beijing Winter Olympics.
That China and Australia will enhance mutual understanding, deepen exchanges and cooperation so that the two people will enjoy friendship for generations to come.
Thanks for your company. For months, we've been told we need to stop focusing on case numbers. It's hospitalizations that really matter, they said. Well, it's taken a while, but it seems that time has very much arrived, partly because even our top health officials admit the reported number of cases, almost 50,000 Australia-wide today, is a significant undercount. The truth is, we don't know how many people are COVID positive right now, but it's a lot more than the official figures. We do know how many people are in hospital with COVID, 2,362, almost double the number reported just last week. 184 are in intensive care, up from 135 last week. And there's early evidence the majority of them have the more severe Delta strain. The number being ventilated is stable for now. There's fierce debate about what will come next, but it's clear intensive care units across the country are already coming under significant strain. The problem, as always, is the number of sufficiently trained staff to deal with those who are fighting for life. Reporter David Taylor begins our coverage.
Mark Nichols is a Sydney-based intensive care doctor. He says the pressure on New South Wales ICUs is building on a daily basis.
We're moving from minimally impacted to moderately impacted intensive care services in New South Wales.
New South Wales recorded 23,131 COVID-19 cases and two deaths in the 24 hours to 8 p.m. yesterday. Another 140 COVID patients were admitted to hospital, sending the state's hospitalisation total past the previous high in last year's Delta outbreak. The number of patients in intensive care rose to 105, up from 95 the day before, with 27 people requiring ventilation. Dr. Nichols, who's president of the Australian and New Zealand Intensive Care Society, says major New South Wales hospitals in the state have reopened their COVID ICU wards and may have to expand these wards further still in days to come.
And so what that means is you then start opening up other spaces and essentially turning those spaces into intensive care units.
But will that be enough to ultimately prevent what the government and the medical profession have been trying to prevent since day one, a rising death toll? Catherine Bennett is chair of epidemiology at Deakin University. She describes the current state of play as a different kind of crisis to what we've been dealing with. That is, patients are being admitted to hospital for non-COVID-related treatment and are subsequently testing positive. It's leading to critical hospital staffing shortages.
So we've got a double pressure on our hospital system, and all of that is going to test our hospital systems in ways that aren't as immediately clear in the numbers that we have reported on a daily basis.
And here's the critical point. Intensive care units can be expanded and more beds and ventilators brought in. And indeed, extra staff can be brought in from interstate and overseas. But each ICU may need many more well-trained and certified specialised nurses in coming weeks. And that may not be possible to achieve, warns Dr. Bennett.
Now it's a much more complex problem, and I'm not sure yet. It's not really a clear picture. We hear different stories from different places about, you know, what is actually really stressing the system at the moment, which of these components and what we can do about it.
But pressure on ICUs across the nation continues to build. There are 516 people in hospital with COVID-19 in Victoria, of whom 56 are in intensive care and 24 are on a ventilator. In South Australia, 102 people are now in hospital, with 12 in intensive care and one on a ventilator. As Catherine Bennett explains, it's the coping capacity of ICUs across the country that stands between a small and a large COVID-19 death toll.
we're still sadly learning about Omicron in our community. We have very high vaccination rates, and there's still sufficient numbers of people in the community who aren't vaccinated, that as adults or 16 and older, that it does pose a threat to us. It does potentially cause our systems to teeter.
As president of the Australian and New Zealand Intensive Care Society, Mark Nichols is acutely aware of the nation's ability to deal with critically ill patients.
It's hard for me to give an exact number. You start to bring in staff from other areas and you start to use other areas of the hospital and establish intensive care units within those. But the staff that come into the unit don't have the intensive care training, so that does increase risk.
How far are we away from that situation?
At the moment, we're okay.
At the moment. That's ICU Dr. Mark Nichols speaking with our reporter, David Taylor. With new infections soaring to new records in almost all Australian states, there's increasing scrutiny on the number of patients in hospital with COVID and those who are being treated for COVID. The Prime Minister wants state and territory leaders to reclassify COVID-19 hospital admissions when National Cabinet meets again tomorrow. Scott Morrison will ask state leaders to consider a uniform definition of pandemic hospitalisations. That is, patients who are being admitted for COVID, as distinct from those being treated for something else but happen to have COVID as well. Reclassifying hospital cases may be useful for predictive data, but medicos are warning it won't redefine the pandemic. Emily Burke reports.
The numbers have driven much of Australia's public health strategy to date, but now there are gaps in the data, largely due to the strain on testing and the revised testing criteria for contacts. But the hospital numbers are known.
2,362 COVID cases are in hospital, almost double the number that were in hospital last week. But 184 cases are in intensive care, and of those, 59 are ventilated, and that is steady.
Dr. Sonia Bennett is Australia's Deputy Chief Health Officer.
The data's not entirely telling us what's happening. I think that's fair to say. And, you know, the numbers we're seeing, people actually being hospitalised for different reasons and happen to have COVID, there's certainly many more cases of COVID out in the community that we're not aware of. That's not necessarily a bad thing, because I think generally that would, where we're seeing COVID is in younger people. It's very mild. Many might not know they have it, or it's just a sniffle.
Stephen Parnas is an emergency doctor in Melbourne. He says the latest surge is different from earlier waves.
We're seeing everything from young, otherwise healthy people who've gotten symptoms of COVID and are desperately worried that they might be becoming more unwell with it, all the way through to patients of every age who live with chronic multiple illnesses who are very fragile. A viral illness, in this case COVID, is enough to tip them over into needing hospital care. And so the challenge for us is to tailor the assessment and treatment that each individual needs, because that cannot be done simply by looking at a web page.
If National Cabinet decides to redefine hospitalisation numbers so that they reflect those with COVID and COVID only, and perhaps those who are presenting to hospitals with other conditions are not classified as COVID hospital patients, what are the implications for that? What are the consequences?
Well, I would reject that approach in the first place. You cannot redefine this pandemic out of existence. Having high positive numbers in the first place is one marker, and certainly the numbers of people needing hospital care with or from COVID is a huge issue. But if someone has COVID and it's making a chronic condition worse, they still have to be treated like any other COVID patient. The staff have to be fully protected behind PPE. The patient needs isolation. They need these extra tests, and we need to be on the lookout for deterioration. So I'd be concerned if the first reaction of any political leader is to try and redefine these things in such a way that they can say that hospitals are doing it easier than we really are.
A lot of the data metrics we look at each day, they help sort of understand where we are in the pandemic.
Data analyst Anthony McCarley is the founder of COVID Live. What would you like to see that gives us the most up-to-date, accurate and true picture of the pandemic?
I think just simply report both figures. So presentations, you know, due to COVID, or presentations due to something else. I think another metric also that we're kind of missing that might be useful is average hospital stay. That might help us evaluate, you know, how serious some of the illness that's going on in the community and those presenting to hospitals.
But will it change what's happening in hospitals before the peak is even reached?
My view would be the hospital system is in crisis.
Dr. Nick Talley is Editor-in-Chief at the Medical Journal of Australia.
At least my colleagues are telling me this clearly in Sydney and elsewhere. And that's a serious problem. It's all about staffing, furloughed staff because of they're infected or family members are infected. All of this is putting enormous pressure. And of course, because of the size of the surge, some people are tipping over and requiring hospitalisation. You know, they are clogging the system, if you like. It just seems to me we're going to have to change gears.
What do you think that'll mean?
I don't think lockdowns are going to work. First of all, I don't think the public would really want them. And secondly, even if you lock down with the virus of this infectivity, it wouldn't extinguish it. There's no way to extinguish this. I think stronger public health measures, though, would be sensible. I mean, requiring masks across most of the nation, particularly using N95 or P2 masks because of the airborne nature of the virus. Density limits more strictly enforced. Some simple measures would take the strain off the hospital system in a few weeks' time if they were instituted. But the trouble is there's always a delay. And so for right now, the hospital system is a real worry.
That's Dr. Nick Talley, Editor-in-Chief at the Medical Journal of Australia. Emily Burke with that report. We have been hearing countless stories of people with suspected COVID who can't get it confirmed because testing services are so overwhelmed. Some have told us they're frightened and don't have good advice on what to do and what to look out for. If that's you or someone you know, lean in. We spoke to Professor Robert Boy, a physician and infectious diseases expert at the University of Sydney, for some basic advice on how to manage COVID at home.
If you think you've got COVID, you've probably got a fever and a cough. You may well be breathless. And if you are an older person with a major medical problem of your heart and lungs or immunosuppression, then you're someone who might be a good candidate for treatment with Sotrovimab, a new monoclonal antibody treatment that's about 80% effective if it's given early on. So people who are older and have major medical problems have already the risk factors for which we want to use monoclonal antibodies as both treatment and early prevention. People who are older and have major medical problems are those that we want to treat COVID early because it can be not only partially preventive, but can also be very effective treatment, 80% in the trials.
Okay, so if you're at home right now and you think you've got COVID, you haven't been able to confirm it, you haven't been able to get through to your state health authority hotline, what should you be doing first up?
If you're at home right now, you think you've got COVID and you think you've got the risk factors for getting severe COVID, you can contact your GP and they can do what's called hospital in the home. They can assess whether you're breathless, whether you've got chest pain and other risk factors, and they can say, hey, you might need immediate transfer to the accident and emergency department where an infectious disease doctor can give you a monoclonal antibody treatment before you get even more severe.
Now, if you don't have a GP, you know, is there any advice you can give people? Should they be drinking a lot of water, taking Panadol, Nurofen? What should people do to self-manage?
If you don't have a GP, you think you've got COVID, you should monitor yourself carefully. You can go on the internet and check for managing COVID at home without a GP. So if you put those words COVID GP management at home, it'll turn up to a sensible, easy approach to looking after yourself. What's important? Hydration, rest. Simple things like ibuprofen and paracetamol can be useful. If your symptoms progress, then you can follow the instructions on the internet. And if you're particularly worried about your state, you can present to the emergency department. But if you've got a trivial problem, don't bother because they won't want to see you.
Yeah, so that's a crucial point because we don't want people turning up unnecessarily, but we also don't want people staying at home when they need to be in hospital. So what are the sorts of things that should trigger a sort of hospital response?
The key things for people to look out for are increasing breathlessness, chest pain, confusion, high fever, and progressive lethargy and fatigue. If you've got several of those, then you may well need to see your GP. And if you can't contact your GP, you may need to go to the accident and emergency department and go there before you get severe so that you don't have to take an ambulance ride and wait for the hard-pressed ambulance service to pick you up.
What should people not do? Because a lot of GPs, for example, don't want you just showing up at their door with suspected COVID.
The majority of people can be managed at home. They can be reassured and they can be assessed by their GP over the phone. They know what to look for. They know how to look after you. They've got experience with managing COVID in the community, and they're going to get only better at doing that.
What about if you've got, say, you know, elderly parents or loved ones or vulnerable parents or loved ones who have suspected COVID? What should you do to sort of monitor them? Should you be checking in on them in the middle of the night or anything like that?
People who have COVID and they're elderly and can't exactly look after themselves well can be helped a lot by their younger relatives, by their children, by their neighbours. And what they can do is check in on them twice a day by phone or a knock on the front door, but by phone is just enough. If you're really concerned, check in the middle of the night. So if people are going to be awake, if you have an agreement with them that they'd like to be checked on at 2 or 3 in the morning, you can do that by phone and make sure that there hasn't been any progression in their symptoms.
And just to make this 100% clear, when you talk about progression of symptoms, you're obviously talking about symptoms getting progressively worse, right?
The kind of things that you worry about with progression of symptoms are increasing confusion, ongoing high fever, worsening breathlessness and chest pain. The skill of GPs and emergency department doctors is only getting better. They're really good at recognising serious cases that need further attention. So trust your GP, work through your GP, and don't go to hospital unless you have symptoms that are very concerning.
Professor Robert Boyd, great to speak to you. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Good to be with you again.
That's Professor Robert Boyd, a physician and infectious diseases expert at the University of Sydney. You're listening to PM on radio on the ABC Listen app and via podcast. I'm David Lipson. Prince Andrew's latest attempt to have a sex abuse case against him dismissed will be considered by a New York court in the coming hours. A key document the prince is relying on has been made public today. It's a settlement agreement between his accuser, Virginia Giuffre, and his one-time friend, the late pedophile financier Jeffrey Epstein. Samantha Donovan has more.
In her civil case against Prince Andrew, Virginia Giuffre alleges the Queen's son forced her to have sex with him at the London home of his friend Ghislaine Maxwell and at two homes owned by Jeffrey Epstein. Prince Andrew denies the allegations, which date back 20 years, and is trying to have the case thrown out of court in the US, arguing Ms. Giuffre is just after money. A document released by the court today is a key part of his case. Signed by Virginia Giuffre in New South Wales in 2009, it details the $500,000 settlement she reached with Epstein after suing him for sexual abuse. American lawyer Moira Kim Penza explains.
The 2009 settlement is significant because Prince Andrew is seeking to dismiss the charges against him entirely that Virginia Giuffre has brought against him. And so he is relying on that settlement agreement as one of the bases for why this complaint should be dismissed in its entirety. And so this is a real question of interpretation of that document, and does it in fact promise what he says it promises?
In her 2009 claim against Epstein, Virginia Giuffre said he'd required her to be sexually exploited by his peers, including royalty. To get the case against him dismissed, Prince Andrew and his lawyers are relying on a clause in the settlement where she agrees not to sue any associate of Epstein who could be included as a potential defendant. But is Prince Andrew covered by that clause? Lawyer Moira Kim Penza.
And so what we will hear are arguments from both sides as to whether or not this was specifically to apply to Prince Andrew and whether, in fact, as a matter of contract law, this could, in fact, have applied to Prince Andrew.
One of Virginia Giuffre's lawyers, David Boies, says the settlement document is irrelevant to his client's claim against Prince Andrew, and her legal team wanted the document made public to refute claims being made about it by what he calls the Prince's PR campaign. He points to the fact the Prince isn't named in it and didn't know about the document. Nigel Cawthorn is the author of a book called Prince Andrew, Epstein, Maxwell and the Palace.
There's no good outcome here for Prince Andrew, because if this case is thrown out at this point because of this document, then it looks like Prince Andrew is just kind of wriggling out on a technicality and is not addressing the various serious offences that she's accusing him of. I mean, it's not just sexual abuse, it's rape in the first degree, is what the complaint says.
Prince Andrew's former friend, Ghislaine Maxwell, is now a convicted sex trafficker, sitting in a New York jail cell awaiting sentencing. Nigel Cawthorn says she could still play a role in the case against the Prince.
If she had been acquitted last week, she would have been kind of the star witness for the defence in this civil case. If she now wants to throw Prince Andrew under the bus, then he's in even more trouble.
If the case against Prince Andrew does go ahead and no settlement is reached, Judge Lewis Kaplan has said it could go to trial late this year.
Samantha Donovan reporting there. A month out from the Beijing Winter Olympics, there's been an unusual show of unity between Chinese and Australian officials. The Games have been mired in controversy, with several nations, including Australia, joining in a diplomatic boycott. But today, differences were briefly set aside. Tracy Holmes joined me earlier. Tracy, there's always plenty of politics leading up to any Olympics, and there's been a lot of controversy surrounding these games. What's the geopolitical landscape look like a month out?
Well, it's totally fraught, isn't it? We're all very well aware of several nations, about half a dozen, that have announced they'll be diplomatically boycotting the games. Not that that makes any difference to the Olympics themselves. In fact, the Chinese officials said they weren't going to invite them anyway. So in that respect, it's not going to make any difference. But there's been a lot of discussion, as we know, fracturing relationship between the West and China, the Uyghur situation, the overt security and oversight that's taking place in China. And of course, something that the world has been wrestling with for 2 years, but China still sticking with its zero COVID policy, just adding a completely new element of challenges ahead of these games.
Despite China-Australia relations being at an all-time low, there's been a show of unity between officials today.
There certainly has been. We saw what you might describe as a very typical Chinese-style press conference. We saw many officials, including the Consul General to Australia, His Excellency Mr. Zhou Limin. We saw the Chargé d'Affaires of the Chinese Embassy, Wang Xining. We saw the head of the Australian Olympic Committee, Matt Carroll. Even John Alexander there, Federal Member of Parliament, of course, a former athlete himself, talking about the incredible unity, and they all spoke of this, the unity that sport brings that only the Olympics can bring, and they hope that this leads to the development of a better future, of better friendships, some cultural experiences. Wang Xining, some people might be familiar with him. He is the embassy staff, the official that spoke at the press club, and is always very forthright in his views, but he actually came close to talking about some of the challenges that the world is facing at the moment, not the least of which, as we mentioned, was COVID.
And we also sincerely hope that China and Australia will enhance mutual understanding, deepen exchanges and cooperation, so that the two people will enjoy friendship for generations to come.
That's Wang Xining, the Chargé d'Affaires at the Chinese Embassy in Canberra. Tracy, what are the facilities looking like there, and what are some of the other considerations a month out?
Look, I think the facilities are amazing. As you would expect, China doesn't go into these things with half a budget or half an attempt. They've thrown everything at it. And I think it's important to point out that what China is actually looking at, their whole modus operandi in bidding for the games and winning the games, is that they are trying to establish a winter sport industry. We know that Chinese athletes are formidable across a whole lot of sports, particularly in the summer sphere, but winter sports are not something that have been a regular part of ordinary Chinese experiences. But of course, after that, we've got this pall that is hanging over a lot of the discussions around China. And so while some people very firmly believe that you have to keep engaged with people in order to make things better and to break down barriers, to build bridges, all of those slogans we know so well, there are others that say the time for diplomacy is well and truly over. You know, this idea that we can expect that countries like China will in fact become democracies, will become more liberal in their thinking, will trust their own people to make decisions and critical thinking is not going to happen. And perhaps we've been sold a dummy thinking that it would by holding up those ideals of democracy. One of those people is Jeffrey Cain. He's the author of The Perfect Police State, talking about the surveillance regime for Uyghurs in Xinjiang province. And he was also one of the people that advised President Biden that signed into law just last week the US Forced Labor Act. This is what he had to say.
The Beijing Olympics is the fact that it's being held there while major crimes against humanity are happening elsewhere in China is just abhorrent.
That's American investigative journalist Jeffrey Cain, and before him, the ABC's Tracy Holmes. Well, how much are Australian kids being taught about climate change? Some would no doubt argue too much. But teachers, academics and environmental groups warn the national curriculum is failing to prepare kids for the life and climate they will face. They hope a review of the Australian curriculum will lead to change, but many aren't holding their breath. Isabel Musali reports.
The beaches are packed for another sweltering day in Perth. Not much reprieve since the city broke its December heatwave record. And while kids will spend their lives experiencing unprecedented after unprecedented weather events, how much do they know about climate change?
Climate change can melt ice in the Antarctica.
It's getting a lot hotter, but I don't know too much about it.
I don't actually know that much, apart from that the world is getting warmer and that we need to do something about it, and there's not really much being done. Hear my friends talking about it a little bit. I sometimes hear it on the news, but yeah, otherwise not that much. I don't really learn much about it in school.
Dr. Brad Gobby from Curtin University, whose research focuses on school curriculums.
So when it comes to climate change, as explicitly mentioned in the Australian curriculum, it's barely mentioned at all. From that, we might say that they're not being taught all that much, although we don't actually know what is being taught in schools, because often you have passionate teachers who want to make a difference to students' lives. So you might be seeing teachers who teaching about climate change in various subjects, but we just don't really know how widespread that might be. Given what the science tells us about climate change, its teaching in schools is not really commensurate with the scale and depth of the crisis that we face.
Some states teach a modified version of the curriculum. The national curriculum is actually being reviewed at the moment, but the Australian Education Union doubts it will lead to change on this subject and warns that would be a missed opportunity. Its federal president is Karina Haythorpe.
The real question here is how long will it take for governments to understand their fundamental responsibility in terms of the political leadership that's necessary to make sure that not only our students but broader society understands the impact, the very real and deep impact of climate change.
Karina Haythorpe says climate change is embedded in the curriculum, but it needs to go much further, and she wants more training and resources for teachers.
It could be significant improvements to the Australian curriculum in terms of climate change, particularly with reference to the Paris Agreement, which recognises the importance of climate change education, training and also raising public awareness.
She believes a series of school strikes in Australia and across the world has only strengthened calls to teach kids more.
Josh Frydenberg, fund our future, not gas!
The Federal Department of Education has told PM, quote, "It's incorrect to say the current curriculum barely mentions climate change. There's substantial opportunities for all students to learn about environmental issues, including climate change." One example it cites is the Year 7 to 10 science curriculum, where students learn about how science and technology is helping give a better understanding of climate change and finding solutions for it. The department also noted the curriculum is being reviewed by the National Independent Authority, but did not say if it expected changes to this topic. Dr. Jennifer Pearson is the president of the Australian Association for Environmental Education and thinks teaching students more about climate change and what difference they can make could actually lift morale.
We owe the children, but also the adults that work with them, because they're the ones that are managing their health and well-being. How do the teachers help the students face the issues that are arising, the sense of loss, the sense of impending doom?
That's Jennifer Pearson from the Australian Association for Environmental Education, ending that story by Isabel Massali. And that's the program for today. I'm David Lipson. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks so much for your company. Good night.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.